Unity Radio is a proud co-sponsor of We Are All Indians Now, an art exhibition by Stephen Johnson Leyba on Friday, March 6th from 6 to 11:30 p.m. at the AFRU Gallery in Portland. We Are All Indians Now is a mixed-media art exhibition that explores Leyba's passion in Native American roots. The artist will share a live performance at 7 p.m. The exhibit will continue from 2 to 6 p.m. on weekends to the end of March. Again, that's We Are All Indians Now, an art exhibition by Stephen Johnson Leyba, on Friday, March 6th from 6 to 11 p.m. at the AFRU Gallery, 534 Southeast Oak Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Everyone in this rich nation of ours should have timely access to the medical care that they need when they need it. The problem in D.C., I think, is that neither the Republicans or the Democrats are assuming any change in the healthcare business model and how healthcare is organized and delivered. We either pay for it or we don't.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Welcome to Inside Washington County. I'm Rob Solomon. Today, our guest is an experienced emergency room physician and healthcare administrator. A member of the Democratic Party, he previously served in the Oregon House of Representatives and Oregon Senate, including as Senate President from 1985 through 1993. He served three terms as governor of our state. He also serves on the National Board of Directors for Families USA, and he holds an endowed chair on healthcare policy at the Foundation for Medical Excellence, an educational foundation that produces continuing education programs for physicians. Our guest is former Governor John Kitzhaber. Today, we bring you part two of our conversation on healthcare. Moving into the CCOs and some of the more details, can you give us a general overview of the operational and financial structure of the health plan, the Oregon Health Plan?
Well, the Oregon Health Plan was created in 1989, and originally it was very controversial. We had a prioritized list that we designed from our benefits from, and if the legislature ran out of money, it couldn't do what we used to do now, just throw people off. Everyone stayed covered. It basically it was everyone under 100% of the federal poverty level. And prior to that, if you were not in a federal category, for example, a pregnant woman or a family with dependent children, you weren't eligible for Medicaid. So if you were a single an individual or a childless couple, you weren't eligible no matter how poor you were, which to me didn't make any sense. So we essentially did what the ACA did 20 years early. We brought it up to 100%. I think the ACA brought it to 138%. But that was the original Medicaid plan. So we expanded coverage to a lot more people. We increased payment a little bit more towards commercial payment. That was implemented finally in 1994, February. And during the first 10 years that it operated, a lot of what are called independent practice associations, physician investor organizations, mm-hmm. developed primarily to provide care under the Oregon Health Plan. They were very, very successful. Family Care in Portland was one of those. A physician care organization. There's a whole bunch of them. And so when we went to the, so that was just our straight Medicaid program. What the CCOs did is they created a system. So we used to have one set of dental care organizations, behavioral health organizations, physical health organizations. And so if you were on Medicaid, you were getting your care from a variety of different entities. And the CCOs brought all those together and put them under one roof. And it's really a partnership between providers and hospitals and local citizens. And they're all required to meet certain, obviously, reserve requirements and demonstrate the ability to manage care. But they're all different. They all look a little bit different than they reflect the local communities from which they operate. So two of them are run by commercial insurance companies. Pacific Source has two, and Moda has one in Eastern Oregon. A couple of them are hospital-based, the one in Inner Community Health down in out of Corvallis. I think about half of them grew out of these independent practice associations. So they're really different. The most complicated one, of course, is in Portland because it's a marriage between a number of hospital systems that compete with each other in many, many other areas.
Sure.
But it's really remarkable when you look at it. And do they have problems? Absolutely. Some of them met the cost curve. Some of them didn't. The state operated within that 3.4%. But within the CCO, some of them were higher. Some of them were lower. So those things have to be worked out. I know the state, Mr. Allen, who runs the Oregon Health Authority now, is working with the CCOs. He calls it CCO 2.0 to try to work out some of those bugs. But I think it's important to remember that this is was a significantly important step forward in terms of trying to recognize that you have to manage cost as you expand access, and that healthcare has to be tied to positive health outcomes and patient satisfaction.
Understood. It's also my understanding that you recently raised a concern about a recent contract or plan that Kate Brown, Governor Brown, organized with coordinating care organizations that would give them responsibility for less direct preventative health measures, such as improving public housing and transportation.
I know that the governor has, I think she had four priorities.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was better mental health, behavioral health integration, which we discussed.
Yes.
One of them is investing in the social determinants of health, which I think is prevention. So I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. I have raised some concerns about when we talk about the CCOs funding or getting involved in social determinants of health, and housing is one of the main ones. I think it's important that we address those areas. At the same time, I think it's important to recognize that CCOs really aren't housing authorities. They're not school boards. I mean, that's not their core competency. So the question is, what is the appropriate role for coordinated care organizations in actually making those upstream investments? And mm-hmm. I think that's an outstanding question. It's not that we shouldn't do it. The question is how to do it without undermining their healthcare function.
Or should they, in fact, be the ones doing it? The point that the need is there is well taken and not being disputed, not here. I'm with you completely. But is a coordinated healthcare organization the organization that should be responsible
right.
for some of those other social determinants? If so, doesn't that take away from their main mission of providing
healthcare? Yeah, and I think that's the question. I'm not being critical, but it's a fair question to ask. And one area where I think that they definitely ought to be involved is that we know now that through what's called epigenetics, that stress during a woman's pregnancy can affect genetic expression. It doesn't change their DNA, but it can turn certain genes on and off. And actually, that's where a lot of the problems that's where the origin of the ACEs comes from, basically. So it's not just adverse childhood experiences that lead to bad outcomes, and, you know, behavioral issues and learning disabilities and things of that nature. It starts much earlier than that. Where are these children seen first? All of these children are seen in the medical system, including the pregnant woman, before they get into the educational system. So I think the first 1,000 days of life, which is where the fundamentals of sort of neural development occur, where you really get your healthy start and get put on the right track, really occur in that first 1,000 days. And that's where they're seen almost exclusively by the medical system, maybe by child care. So the medical system could do the screening. They could try to identify those risk factors that those children have, whether it's in a family setting where we have a substance abuse issue, or where there's an absent parent, or it's just a food insecurity issue or a housing issue. That, to me, is a huge role, important role for them. And then that has to be connected to the ability to get the right resources to the right child and family at the right time for long enough to make a difference.
Well, that's just extending certain physician or provider responsibilities. It's like when my mom was losing her capacity to drive, she went to a, as she had dementia issues, She went to her doctor's office and the receptionist noticed that she didn't park very well at all. We won't go into details. Mentioned it to the doctor and that was reported to the DMV and the appropriate action was taken. And you're simply saying, let's broaden that out and let's look at the first 1,000 days. Let's look at our young folks, our infants, and see if we can do some good preventative work. I understand that you have also expressed a concern about how healthcare is financed in America, in that more attention and dollars are directed toward dealing with the aftermath of chronic conditions rather than preventing those conditions in the first place, just as we're talking. From your perspective, how can we reprioritize and adopt more effective preventative strategies across the board?
So there's a couple of things that are required. First, we have to recognize and accept the fact that health is not the product of our medical system primarily. It is the product of the investments we make in people, in our communities, in our children, in our families. It's the product of having a good job and income security. It's the product of having a safe home environment. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you've got to be able to identify that segment of the population that is at highest risk. I mean, you know, we have finite resources. You want to put your dollars where they're most needed. And we have the ability now to identify at-risk children by zip code, by neighborhood, almost by household. So it's not that we don't know where these folks are, and we have to understand the nature of those risk factors. And then the two things that are missing is it has to be funded. You have to be able to put money behind that. And the amount of money, the return on investment is probably 7 or 8 to 1. I mean, it's huge. So we have to have the discipline to fund it. And I think the only way you're going to make room in the budget to do it is you've got to reduce the rate of increase of medical care, because that's the Pac-Man. That's the single biggest all funds expenditure in Oregon and in most states, right? And then the last piece, which I think we don't talk about often, is you have to have a delivery system that can actually get those services to the right children and families at the right time and for long enough to make a difference. And the problem is we have all sorts of really good organizations and agencies and CBOs and not-for-profits operating in that space, but in many cases they operate in their own silos. They often compete with each other from the same funding sources, and so kids go through this program and that program and this program and that program, and we need to put the child first and figure out where the various services need to intersect. Now, Kaiser is doing something very interesting called Thrive Locally. That might actually be a good folks to get on your show. But what they're doing is they're trying to identify those social services and connect them with the medical record. So that, let's say that a person's in the hospital and they can get them out of the hospital, but they don't have a place to go to, mm-hmm. right? Or it's a meal issue. And so they're trying to, it's a model starting in Northwest to sort of begin to develop that kind of system that we need. Assuming we have the resources, you need that system to get that help to the people who need it.
Well, that makes sense, but I thought, my naivete, I thought the healthcare system was supposed to be paying attention to that, and no one was discharged without a social work intervention to make sure that they either had a place to go or care at home or things like that.
Well, often they don't. Right, and you have to kind of look around, and what this is, and I'm probably, I don't want to pretend that I'm totally accurate here. I had a quick briefing on it, but it'd be worth looking at it. But it's more of a coordination, and also the agencies that they refer their people to have certain outcomes. So I mean, so there's some quality standards built into it. It's just starting. Nicole Friedman. Over at Kaiser, I think, is in charge of that, and it would be really interesting to look at that. It's definitely trying to invest upstream.
Excellent, thank you. I had asked earlier about your preference among the Democratic plans, and the reason I did that instead of saying Democratic and Republican plans is because I'm not sure that I've heard of a Republican plan. But that leads us to, how can we get this to be non-political? In other words, where can Republicans and Democrats find common ground for improving healthcare access and affordability?
Well, you know, this is not ultimately a partisan issue. I can tell you that in the 15 years I practiced medicine in the ER, I never checked someone's party registration before I saw them. I have never wondered whether Republicans believe different than Democrats or whether cardiovascular problems or cancer respect ideology and party registration. So it's really pretty crazy. I think Washington, D.C. has become so deeply and bitterly polarized that it's all about, you know, one-upsmanship and getting the next the advantage for the next, you know, the next election cycle. So it may be that the reform has to arise from the state level. And one of the things that I have been thinking about is if you look at the three West Coast states, Oregon, Washington, California, they've all expanded under the ACA. We have something in place now called the Pacific Coast Collaborative, which is it's Oregon, Washington, California, and British Columbia that we have used to deal with regional issues. So, for example, in 2013, I met in San Francisco with Jay Inslee and Jerry Brown and Christy Clark, who was the Premier of British Columbia, and signed something called the West Coast Climate and Energy Action Plan.
Yes.
So what if we were to create a structure along the West Coast that is similar to the modeled after the Pacific Coast Collaborative, but to develop a regional approach to medical care and to try to develop the things we've been talking about in that market? That is, if you think about it, it's the fifth largest economy in the world. You have just Medicare and Medicaid, 23 million people. If you can negotiate prices for those, it would be pretty significant. You've got six U.S. senators, you've got three governors, you've got 68 members of Congress, you've got 10 people on the Energy and Commerce Committee, which is the committee of jurisdiction in the House, and we have two senators, Senator Wyden and Senator Cantwell, that are on the Senate Finance Committee. I'm just saying that ultimately you need federal action, but maybe the way it starts is the way we started the Oregon Health Plan or the CCOs. We designed what we think is a better system. They give us the waivers and the flexibility to try it out.
When it would be stronger to start it regionally than any one state to do it.
Exactly.
But if I may, you wouldn't include British Columbia in that, I would assume. You have emphasized, at least on the 2010 campaign trail, how concern over how end of life is financed. And frankly, since 2010, I've heard you express concern in other circumstances. How do we balance providing a decent quality of life for patients near death with the realities of the incredible costs and Medicare's limited resources?
I think this is an issue where we need to try to accommodate the desires of most people. So I'll just tell you a real quick story. So there's very few people who want to die in an acute care hospital. You know, that's why we have advanced directives. That's why
we have hospice.
We have hospice, right? So that's not what most people want. I lost my own mom in 2005, and she was 88, and She had a lot of pain. I went with her the last time she saw a physician, and she had muscle pain, real bad muscle pain, and she had what's called erythroid sedimentation rate, which is a lab test for inflammation. It was really high, and she had a little bit of blood in her stool. So the possible diagnosis was an undiagnosed cancer. And the workup would have been really invasive, colonoscopes and endoscopes and biopsies, and she just didn't want it. And so the doctor said, well, we'll just check your blood, you know, lab every couple weeks and see how you do. And I said, why? And there was this sort of uncomfortable silence. I said, you know, if you continue to check the blood work on an 88-year-old woman, you're going to continue to find abnormalities because she's 88 years old. Mm-hmm. My friend Don Berwick once said, there's no such thing as a healthy person, just someone who hasn't had enough tests yet. So she decided just to go home. And she had made this conscious decision between care and cure. Mm-hmm. And there's a point, the threshold all of us will cross where you can't cure anymore because we are in fact mortal. So now it's a caring issue, which is different. So she went home and the quality of her life changed instantly. She and my dad had been living around the lab and going up and down the hill and wondering how to adjust the medications. And so they'd been living around their disability and the fact that they were mortal and they were up in their late 80s and early 90s. Suddenly they let go of that. And they embraced what they could control, which was the joys and blessings of their 63-year marriage. So she lived another, I don't know, maybe 8 months, never saw a doctor again. They called in some things. She never went to a hospital, back to the hospital. She died of congestive heart failure. It was very sad. But she was in bed with my dad, and the whole family was there. It was beautiful at the same time because it's what she wanted. So the point is that our system would have paid to put her in the hospital for atrial fibrillation or renal failure or a whole host of other legitimate issues and the ambulance to take her there. but it won't pay adequately for a provider to spend time talking with her about what she wants her end of life to be like, and not at the end of life, but maybe when she's 30 or 40. And it wouldn't pay for a non-hospice caregiver to help her stay in her home. Hospice is great, but she needed someone to take her to the bathroom. She needs, right? And we have some resources, so she's able to do it. So my point is that the end of life is not a medical issue. It is an interpersonal issue. It's an issue of compassion and caring and comfort. And I just think that if we were to begin to have that conversation earlier and respect what people want, that the vast majority of people would not want to end their life in an acute care hospital. And if you want to, you can do it. We're not saying you can't. I'm just saying that is misaligned, that healthcare system is misaligned with what I think most people actually desire.
You know, it's interesting because it seems to me that the only real core answer to that, I agree, people don't want to die in hospitals, but I think a primary issue is people don't want to die at all. And if they think that there's a better chance of at staying alive an extra day, I know if people are in terrible pain, that's a different story. But if they think they can stay alive an extra day in a hospital, they might want to because of fear. I put this all together and I put to you, is perhaps the real issue here helping people to get over the fear of death?
Well, it's a conversation we don't have very well in our society. You got time for another quick story? So just bear with me a second. I took a friend from New York down the Rogue River a number of years ago in August, someone who basically was a big city person, big city woman. So, and it's the salmon running. And one day we float by this big male Chinook, maybe 40 pounds, just an incredible creature. But he's struggling. You know, he's heading upstream, but he's struggling because of the current and his growing strength, you know, and he's just all torn up. I mean, you've seen those big volumes. Fins are tattered. He's got scars on his side and his fungus on his head. And you know, he's still way downstream from the spawning beds. He's probably never going to make it. You know, in his death, he's going to give his body to the river and provide the nutrients to the next generation. So I've always felt that the life cycle of salmon is this lovely metaphor for not only a relationship between life and death, but the responsibility that each generation has to the next. So my friend looks at this fish and she goes, "My God, what's wrong with that fish?" And without even thinking, I said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with him. He's just dying." And part of it is that our society views death as this abnormal, adverse outcome and not actually as a part of the overall life process. And I think part of it is we don't talk about it very much and have that conversation. I guess that's really what I'm saying is we all face it. If the only time you have it is when you're faced with it, it's much more scary than if you have that conversation as a part of your relationship with your primary care provider or with your, you know, your pastor.
Agreed. Religion is relevant here, but only to a point, because I'm talking in terms of how medical care relates to this.
Well, so I would say, and I don't have the statistics, but I believe they would bear me up, that most people, if they do not want to end up in a hospital. I mean, I think that's my mother. That's a decision my mom made. I don't think you say that to the ones that want to that you don't, but it's part of it's family members. I can tell you, seeing a gentleman who had a brainstem infarct in Roseburg, a stroke in his lower brain, who's not going to breathe again. And he came in the ER, we were ventilating him, and I called his son who's in New York, and his son was feeling guilty because he hadn't called him on Father's Day, and we had that conversation. He says, "Well, just keep him alive until I get there." Now think about that for a second. This gentleman is never going to breathe again. We put him on a ventilator, put him in the intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. The cost is significant. It will not change the outcome. The son flies out and arrives, and the only choice for him is to make the decision to disconnect him from the ventilator, which is in itself another really emotional, difficult thing for him to do. So having the conversation early and having an advance directive and having your family involved and having those conversations, we need to encourage that. It doesn't solve the problem, and ultimately what you're getting at is there is a point, if you're using public resources, which is really what we're at issue here, is there a point at which the healthcare needs of one individual begin to interfere with the ability of another individual to get other basic needs? Does end-of-life care take public dollars away from healthy children? Those are difficult questions, and legislative bodies are not very well adept to answer them. So the answer is to have those questions have those conversations in the community.
It seems to me, I'm challenging my memory again, but it was way back in the 70s that then Colorado Governor Richard Lamb,
very good friend of mine,
he talked in terms of end of life care, and he talked in terms, it came out as, the governor's talking about rationing health care.
Yeah.
And I believe the screams were heard perhaps around the world.
So I had lunch with him about 2 months ago in Denver. He was a little bit misquoted, but his point was, so when we did the Oregon Health Plan, if rationing means you don't give someone care they need, if you cut someone from coverage, mm-hmm. you're rationing that human being.
You are.
You're not giving them the care they need. We do it all the time. We just are not accountable for it. Here's another story. So when I was first Senate president, in those days the Oregon legislature had, it met every other year, there was something called the Emergency Board that was chaired by the president and speaker of the House, right? So our Medicaid budget goes out of line. And so I go up to Salem, I was brand new on the Emergency Board, and we put a little money from the Emergency Fund into the Medicaid program, and we cut doctors' payments a little bit, and we changed income eligibility, we lowered it, 4,300 people lost coverage. I'm sitting there thinking, wow, that was easy. I'm sitting here, nice spring day going on outside, we look at some numbers, take some votes, balance the budget. But I was still feeling kind of something, some disquiet there. So I go back to the ER, and in September, I see this guy come in, about 45, 46-year-old man with really bad hypertension, and he had this huge stroke, because he lost the ability to purchase his blood pressure medication, right? So I was as responsible for his death as anybody, but none of the other legislators actually had to see the consequence, right? So my point is that we ration all the time, and the question is we should do it with some honesty and accountability, right? And I don't believe you actually have to. We have enough money in this system to give everybody virtually everything that they can, that can meaningfully help them, if we change how that system's organized and delivered and change the financial incentives in it.
Understood.
Dick Lamb, who's particularly well known for a study he claims he did on death rates, he says, I study death rates in all five continents, every country, every city, every county, and the result was they're all the same, one per person.
Fair enough. In 1945, then President Harry Truman proposed universal health care, but it took 20 years for the Medicare Act to pass. How long do you think it's going to take to see the universal health care that you say and lots of people in this country say that they want?
Well, I think there's two possible outcomes. We will change the current system is not financially sustainable. If the couple of the biggest drivers in the national debt now are Medicare and Medicaid, it's $23 trillion, and Medicaid is going to grow from 50 million to about 75 million over the next decade as the rest of the boomers come on. So it's just
sure.
It's going to, right? So we're going to have a debt crisis at some point, or we're going to have a revolt of private sector payers, being employers who are paying most of the tab along with the government. So if we don't get ahead of it, the system that emerges will be the result of a financial crisis. And the objective in Congress will be to avoid defaulting on the national debt, not to create a system that thoughtfully creates a framework for everyone to have access to care. So that's the worst case scenario. It'll change, but it will not be good. If we get ahead of it, if people acknowledge that we have to change the system, and that if we can agree on an objective and a set of design principles, and then work the inevitable politics through, I think that within a decade we could have a system that makes sense, that's where the costs are being controlled, and where we're beginning to recognize that health is the product of medical care, but it's also the product of a lot of things we're underfunding now, which is the human infrastructure, it's the children, it's the families, it's the housing, it's the economic opportunities.
Governor, philosophically perhaps, is health care a right or a privilege for Americans? What should
Great question.
It be?
I don't like that term. I would reframe, because I think it takes us down the wrong rabbit hole. It basically means that every last dollar we should spend on health care. I think it's more productive to say every American should have an equal opportunity to be healthy, which implies a guaranteed right to a certain level of effective health care,
yes.
But also housing and a job and a safe community and a clean environment, right? All those other things. So I think we need to broaden the discussion from healthcare to health. And until we do that, I mean, Senator Warren, who I have great respect for, and I totally embrace the value proposition in her Medicare for All bill. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, let's just say it costs $20 trillion. We can argue on the margins. Mm-hmm. Why would you put an additional $20 trillion into a system that we know wastes 30 cents on every dollar we spend and will make it so much more difficult to invest in those other things that Democrats say they believe in and which will actually improve the health and equity and opportunity in our country?
Governor, thank you so very much for your time and your input. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We also want to thank our intern, Shauna Muckle, for her excellent research.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Rick Paulson.
Next up at 9:30, we have Good Vibes Only with KBOO's Dresden De Vera interviewing Sarah Bardial and Aaron Cronin, two board members of the nonprofit Weird Portland Unit.
KBOO Community Radio, and up next is the Good Vibes Only segment. On this episode, I'm speaking to Sarah of Weird Portland United, a nonprofit group whose mission statement is to gather the eccentric X-Men of the city in order to battle the forces of normal. Sarah is a volunteer board member, and this is our conversation.
How would you describe Weird Portland United for those that don't know what it is yet?
I can tell you what the mission is, because that explains it really well.
Yeah.
Weird Portland.